Blog Talk Radio.
Try again.
I just
That was the problem. I'm wondering if it's still there and marked there, but may not be able to find it.
Eager to see one of their own sitting just a heartbeat away from the Oval Office. Then at the crack of an assassin's bullet, the president could be slain, and ka-ching, the cash registers would be rung as President Cantor, an ardent Zionist, and an Israeli firster is sworn in. For now, it's all Newt Gingrich. He has been ultra-loyal both to Jewish money men and to the secretive Vatican group Opus Dei, which we read before. To prepare Gingrich for his role as Rothschild's frontman in 2012, he was converted to Catholicism, which I read before. Also present at this...
Jesuit Father Robert.
The Jewish Jesuit. Also present at when he made his conversion, was Jesuit Father Robert Spitzer, a Jewish person who was chairman of the Vatican's Magus Institute and Spitzer Center. The Jesuit order is, in fact, a crypto-Jewish organization, and Spitzer is one of the many Jewish people who claims to have converted to Catholicism. He and the debauch Gingrich must have really been laughing up their sleeves. Legatus has some 1,800 members with heavy presence in the United States, Canada, and Ireland. Gingrich thrilled the attendees in California by showing them his new film, Gingrich Productions, that just produced about the exemplary life of the late Pope John Paul II. The theme of the Legatus Conference was challenging the culture. Gingrich's third wave plan for America. And just what kind of culture does Mr. Gingrich want to see take hold in America? In my insightful, eye-opening book, Circle of Intrigue, this is
Tex Mars
talking, I amassed the traitorous and anti-American intentions of Gingrich and his associates in crime. I have an enormous political ambition, Gingrich told the Political Post. I want to shift the entire planet, and I'm doing it. The planetary shift of Gingrich takes a number of dangerous forms. It is, in fact, all part of the revolutionary socialist movement, which Gingrich calls the third wave. The plan calls for nothing less than to radically change America into a fascist paradise with citizens stripped of constitutional rights. What is planned is a virtual high-tech prison, an Orwellian police state superintended by the self-appointed masters. Gingrich has not been shy about presenting his third wave plan. He flatly states that it is his goal to end the old America forever. Inside is Alvin and Heidi Toffler enlisted the endorsement of Gingrich, and the three set forth his plan in the Toffler's sinister Illuminatist volume, Creating a New Civilization. Gingrich actually wrote the foreword for this ungodly anti-American book. Here are just a few of the third wave principles espoused in the book by the Tofflers and Gingrich.
The time has come for the next great step forward. Time has come for the next great step forward in American politics. It is not a matter of Democrats versus Republicans or left and right, but something more significant, a clear distinction between rearguard politicians who wish to preserve or restore an unworkable past and those who are ready to transition to what we call a third wave information age society. A new civilization is emerging in our lives. And now these are the words of Newt Gingrich. A new civilization is emerging in our lives, and blind men everywhere are trying to suppress it. This new civilization brings with it new family styles, changed ways, a new economy, new political conflicts, and altered consciousness. Humanity faces a quantum leap forward, and this is the meaning of the third wave. Our
argument is based on what we call the revolutionary premise. The revolutionary premise liberates our intellect and will. Nationalism is first wave, the globalization of business and finance required by advancing third wave economies routinely punctures the national sovereignty the nationalists hold so dear. As economies are transferred by the third wave, they are compelled to surrender part of their sovereignty. Poets and intellectuals of third wave states sing the virtues of borderless world and planetary consciousness. The third wave demassifies culture, values, and morality. There are more diverse religious belief systems. The Constitution of the United States needs to be reconsidered and altered. This is Gingrich talking.
This is all Gingrich.
To create a whole, in other words, he wants to throw out the Constitution, creates a whole new structure of government, building a third wave civilization on the wreckage of second wave institution involves the design of new, more appropriate political structures that he tells us we need.
Yeah.
The system that served us so well must in turn die and be replaced. Isn't that like...
His ex-wife must die and be replaced.
Yeah, he did that twice.
Yeah. Hey.
Isn't that like being a traitor?
One was dying, and he said, hey, babe, I'm divorcing you.
Isn't this like writing about being a traitor to the country?
Exactly. Yeah.
I mean, isn't that what that is?
I mean, if they don't put that in there, I don't, you know, I can't understand.
He says outright that he wants to destroy the Constitution.
That's right.
That means destroying the country.
That's what he wants to do. System that serves us so well must be replaced. Must in its turn die and be replaced. Gingrich's goal is smash Christianity and end American sovereignty. To say that these proposals mesh with plan the great work of the Satanists of the Illuminati hierarchy is a gross understatement. Even Barack Obama and his cohorts do not have the boldness and the gall to so clearly elaborate the goals of the elite. Gingrich and Toffler openly declare their goals to smash Christianity and American sovereignty, erase all national borders, wreck our entire existing civilization, and kill off America's 200-plus-year constitutional history forever. Gingrich is a communist revolutionary who dares to state outright what he intends to destroy the
United States.
To destroy the United States and set up a totalitarian New World Order. Gingrich lionized by the Republican Party.
Yet amazingly, Tex Mar is apparently the only man in the world who has reported on this atrocity of Newt Gingrich's. The man continues to be lionized by the Republican Party. He is a frequent talking head. Indeed, he's a paid contributor of Fox News TV's channel, and everywhere the elite applaud his every move. And now, if our Jewish controllers have their way, these are Zionists, this vicious traitor to the American way of life will be the Republican Party standard bearer in the sweepstakes for the American presidency. For the moment, Barack Obama is doing just fine as far as the Illuminati fraternity is concerned. His administration, guided by Zionist swindlers like Rahm Emanuel, David Axelrod, Timothy Geithner, and Ben Bernanke, has loaded up the globalist banks with over $37 trillion of stolen taxpayer money. They were able to push through the greatest socialist scheme in American history with the Obamacare scam, and so things are going swimmingly for super rich who monitor things behind the scenes. But if Obama should falter, they will not hesitate in 2012 to replace the half-blood prince of Chicago with a more promising puppet, a Gingrich, for example, or even Palin, Romney, or Cantor. And Hillary is always an option.
Yeah. There's also the ominous specter of Hillary always lurking in the shadows.
Oh, God.
President Bill Clinton's 8-year reign is a very fond memory for the elite. And why not a rerun with lesbian flourishes courtesy of the ubiquitous Secretary of State Hillary Rodham Clinton? The best part of their thinking is that Hillary is a Jew.
She's a Zionist.
Yeah, and she even, well, he says Jew.
Yeah, well,
she even told the New Yorker magazine that her grandmother spoke Yiddish in her name and cooked Jewish delicacies
in her home.
In the Rodham kitchen. Rodham was her maiden name. And now that is a good fit for President in Rothschild's eyes. So both the lesbian Wiccan hag friends of Hillary and the Masonic occult of the Jewish Kahila might say, so mote it be.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, he's got that stuff.
I have to say that text doesn't mince any words, folks.
No, he doesn't. But I suggest you go to textmars.com and check that out, Power of Prophecy. Very, very good article about Newt Gingrich.
I think he understands who Newt is.
I think he does.
What scares me is Newt is just not a very nice person.
No.
That's the scariest thing. Let them eat debt. How about that?
Yeah, this is regarding reports in Italy suggest that the IMF is drawing up plans for a $600 billion assistance package for the country. Spain may be offered access to the IMF credit rather than a rescue package to avoid it being picked off by the markets in the coming weeks. Any IMF involvement in European rescue packages would be partly underwritten by British taxpayers, which could leave this country liable if Italy and Spain did not repay any international loans. And Britain provides 4.5% of the IMF funding and would therefore face a potential liability to an Italian package of up to $27
billion. Well, who owns the 96%?
The United States owns 51% or more. And the other countries are...
Well, geez, they'd only be responsible for 4.5%, but we'd be responsible for 50%. I don't feel sorry for them.
Yeah, no, it's true.
I'm not crying for the British.
I wanted to check this out because but I couldn't get on the
excuse me.
The Fed sees 130 plus domain names in a mass crackdown. I was trying to get in to see what that article was, and for some reason
I don't understand why they're seizing the domain names.
Right. Right. And there was a lot of counterfeit going on. A lot of counterfeit names, people putting them up. No, it's not coming up. No. Sorry, folks. Sorry, that's a problem I had earlier, too. But I'll just read quickly what it states. U.S. authorities have initiated the largest round of domain name seizures yet as part of their continued crackdown on counterfeit and piracy-related websites. With just a few days to go until Cyber Monday, well, we already had Cyber Monday, but more than 100 domain names have been taken over by feds to protect the commercial interests of U.S. companies. Seizures are disputable, as the SOPA bill, which aims to specifically legitimize such actions, is still pending in Congress. So it's interesting. I guess that a lot of people are putting it there, like, you know, Apple got two or something, you know what I mean? And profiting from it. This is happening here. Military confrontation between Washington and Moscow. Russia warships head for Syria. Now, this is, I thought this was fascinating because we're looking at, there's a Russian standoff here. With Syria. They're going down to protect Syria. Moscow is deploying warships at its base in the Syrian port of Tartus. The long-planned mission comes providentially at the very point when it could help prevent a potential conflict in the strategy important Middle East country. The Russian battle group will consist of three vessels led by the heavy aircraft carrying missile cruiser Admiral Kuznetsov.
Kuznetsov.
And Russian military officials insist that the move has no connection with the ongoing crisis in the region and was planned a year ago. And apart from Syria, the aircraft carrier and its escort ships are set to visit the Lebanese capital, Beirut, Genoa, Italy, and Cyprus, says the former chief of NATO staff, Admiral Viktor Kavchenko. Now, I wonder if they're going to Beirut and Lebanese. Yeah, they should put that plant that aircraft carrier outside of Gaza.
Yeah.
And let open up that boycott. Nevertheless, he added that the president
don't care about that.
Military force other than NATO is very useful for this region because it will prevent the outbreak of an armed conflict. The Russians said. So it's getting kind of interesting there.
China supports Pakistan in row over the NATO border attack, which we've heard about. China has stepped into the toxic dispute between Pakistan and the United States, expressing its deep shock and strong concern over the deaths of Pakistani soldiers bombarded by NATO helicopters at Border Pass Post. The intervention by the Chinese Foreign Ministry comes at a time when relations between the U.S. and Pakistan are at the most strained for many years. It is being seen as a move by Beijing to strengthen its already close ties with Islamabad in the wake of Saturday's air attack in which 24 Pakistani soldiers died. The Prime Minister of Pakistan, Yousaf Raza Gilani, has threatened to revisit engagement with NATO following the deaths at the Mohammed border post, the deadliest such incident since the start of the Afghan war in 2001. Business as usual will not be there, Gilani told CNN.
Oh, okay. And?
You have about 3 minutes or 4 minutes, and then you can
okay.
call your
yeah, that's fine.
Our guest.
John's going to have an article tonight that he brought with him, it's on the Fukushima.
Oh, okay.
But it tells you how bad Fukushima really is, and tells you what's going on around the world with it. You know, it's just news we haven't heard much about.
No, news about Fukushima certainly is not on mainstream at all. They never even mentioned it. You'd think it never happened.
Yeah. Oh yeah. This one was a little strange, but Fukushima is Japanese genocide. I agree.
They're irradiating us.
Yeah. There's a quote. It says, "I agree. The nuclear accident in Japan seemed to be geological and
genocidal
in design, posing to weaken the DNA structure of its people to premature pathogens and degenerative diseases, resulting in shorter lifespans and creating a radical population reduction there. This genocidal action may have been in the works for some time, even as far back as the Second World War, as the firebombing in Japan and on civilian targets was unconscionable." To wit, General Bonner Fellers, an advisor to General MacArthur, wrote that the U.S. bombing of Japan was among the most ruthless and barbaric killings of non-combatants in all of history. Yeah.
That's pretty awful.
And this article talks about the part that...
This is from HenryMacko.com.
Yeah. Macko is kind of a... You can take him or leave him with a grain of salt, but sometimes he comes up with some really fascinating
this
things.
This is by Howard Francis. Teaching in a Japanese school, Howard Francis is amazed at how cohesive they are as a people. He speculates the Fukushima was designed by the NWO to break them down. I'm currently teaching English as a second language at a Japanese school located in China. The experience has taught me that the Japanese have a very strong and independent culture. This is presumably due to their isolationist history. When I first arrived, I was shocked by how civilized the Japanese are in comparison to the Chinese. As I walk through the school, every child and member of the staff smiles at me, bows their head, and says, "Hello, Mr. David." The classes are easy to teach. The children have a positive attitude and want to excel. Children who cause trouble are ostracized by the other kids. In one of the rare moments when a class gets out of control, rather than shouting, my Japanese co-teacher says in measured tone, "Your behavior is not polite and you're insulting the school and your family." All the children hang their heads in shame. The students have various chores they need to fulfill. They have to clean the school during break and lunch times, including the toilets. There's no vacuum cleaner. The children clean the carpets with an adhesive tape. This might sound strict, but the children carry out their chores with gusto. They enjoy being in an environment they respect. In contrast, the rich Chinese children I have taught are uncivilized, called little emperors by their indulgent grandparents that raised them. They are rude, unpredictable, and constantly demand attention. There is a big push for being healthy and energetic. Okay, let me just finish this. Various posters tell the children how to eat well. After one of my classes, I was amazed to see all the children go downstairs, get on their trainers, and hit the track. They're training for a marathon. The gender relations between the teenagers are healthy. In my teenage classes, the boys and girls are very modest and shy.
So it's a long article, but it talks about the way that they accept genocide in that culture, passively. And we have our guest coming up here in 1 second, and I have to. bear with me. I know I'm not doing this correctly, but it's
And we'll have Lori tell us a little bit about herself.
Yes, Lori Bassey is coming up, our guest tonight, and she is a
author
of.
She's written a huge number of books.
I don't know if you.
We don't have that.
Good Company is the name of her.
Most recent.
Her book, and
we'll have her tell us about her background, a little bit about her background.
Yeah.
Lori Bassey.
Oh, good evening, Lori. This is Lila.
And
hi, Lila.
Hey. We're with the LA Stool Show. How are you?
Very well, and yourself?
Very good, thank
you. Very good, too. And we would like you to tell our listeners a little bit about your background.
The Bassey, your company, and how you got onto human capital management.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
So please just indulge us a little and give us our listeners some of your
a little background information about
okay.
how you got into taking the study and
how you came up with Good Company
and where it's taking you. Yeah.
Okay. Well, I'm an economist by training, but I like to tell people that I'm a very nice person anyway, despite that. card-carrying economist, and I actually started on the journey that led me and my co-authors to write this book, Good Company. It was about 25 years ago with a conversation that changed my life.
Oh.
I found myself in a steel mill in western Maryland interviewing workers about their, quote, learning environment. And I was then a young assistant professor at Georgetown. I knew the rules of the game, publisher perish, and everything was kind of a fancy mathematical equation to me. So I was there interviewing these workers, disgusting, horrible work conditions about their non-existent learning environment. And one of the workers said to me at the end of the day, "Lady, I can pretty much sum it up for you like this. I go home at the end of every day whooped, tired, and disgusted." And I thought, wow, that really doesn't fit neatly and tidily into my data coding scheme here. and sometimes when you have a conversation, the words just kind of sink into your soul and permeate you and stir around in you. And that was one of those conversations that just hung with me and hung with me and hung with me. And it really caused me to change my life and the way I thought about my work. And ultimately it culminated in the publication of this book called Good Company.
I wondered what kind of parameters you use to determine what is a good company, how you develop those parameters.
Well, Lila, they fall into one of three buckets. So we actually create something called the Good Company Index. We try to be very objective, quantitative, and transparent, forthcoming about this. So the three pillars of the Good Company Index are, number one, is the firm a good employer? Number two, is it a good seller? Is it good to its customers? And number three, is it a good steward of the communities and the environment, the communities in which it works? And then we have a number of, ways of decompacting that and objectifying it and assigning points. It's all, as I said, very objective and transparent. It's on our website, which is goodcompanyindex.com.
Now, one of the questions I had about that was, are you comparing, a food company to a manufacturing company to a retail company? I mean, the judgments for those three companies could be very different.
What we do, yes, they are. And the rules of the game do vary, across industries, although there are some things that are common to all industries. for example, you know, they all have people working for them. So this, you know, this good employer thing is has some common elements to it. But what we do is we look at what we call matched sets of firms. So we look at firms within the same industry, like within finance or, you know, grocery stores or entertainment, and we ask ourselves, what difference does it make? Does this good company concept actually help firms perform better than their competition? Mm-hmm. And what we find is that within matched pairs of firms, that is to say they're in the same industry, the firms with the higher good company grade outperform their less worthy counterparts. In the last year, they've outperformed them, for example, by 19.8% in the stock market. So it really, it pays to be a good company.
Well, let's look at Goldman Sachs for a minute. Since you have an investment company that you run,
so you understand that.
Yeah. Let's look at Goldman Sachs. How they were rewarded by doing the most evil, horrible, manipulative, catastrophic events ever known by a company, and yet they're going to walk away with this. This company bet against its own investors.
Yeah, pretty bad stuff. Really bad behavior on the good seller front.
So what kind of rating would Goldman Sachs receive according to your...
It's interesting that you hone in on exactly that example. That was the one that my co-authors and I probably struggled with the most.
Right? Yeah.
According to our grading system, they got a B. Now,
a B.
You know, I'm not happy with that grade, but you know, I'm an ex-university professor, and you know, I know it's not fair to cheat on your own grading system. So we gave them a B very, very reluctantly because that is how they came out on the scale. You know, knowing that they've done a lot of bad stuff.
Does that mean your system is flawed?
Does that mean our system is flawed? I would say our system, it being a human system, is imperfect. And I think you've touched upon one of the. It's interesting that you found probably the, you know, what we consider to be the weakest link in our system. I don't think it's a perfect system, Lila. I think it's a very good step in the right direction.
Okay.
But I don't understand where my problem arises here is that in human capital management, all right, it's so dehumanizing, the sound of it. It sounds like the word itself, human capital management, sounds like
sounds a bit Orwellian.
Well, extremely Orwellian.
Yeah, it's, you know,
you know, we're so reduced to a human capital, like collateral damage. You know what I mean? It's
you know,
just
people who work in this field really, really struggle with the language. I'll be the first to admit it. The language is definitely imperfect in this emerging discipline of people management.
Mm-hmm.
When you think about the alternatives, human resources, personnel, you know, those aren't lovely terms of art either. So I'm definitely not in love with the term human capital, but at least it does have a notion of, you know, assets. People are assets, as opposed to just costs.
According to so many corporations, I mean, the whole concept behind a corporation is to mold your people into a team effort. You know,
right? Would you agree with that?
Mm-hmm. I worked in corporations, and that was always the goal. Not that they achieved it, but you know, it was definitely a goal in mind. You know, that they pounded into everybody daily. You know, just teamwork. You know, that kind of thing.
Well, when you're in sales,
especially, it's always like that.
But let me just go back to Goldman Sachs. Where do you think, I happen to be a little anti-corporation, I have to tell you that, you know.
No kidding.
I feel like they're the 1% and I'm part of the 99%. I sympathize with the Occupy Wall Streeters. So
I'm with you.
Okay, I have to let you know that. So I'd like to know, you as the developer of this system, where, and you said yourself that you felt very bad that you gave Goldman Sachs a B. Where do you mm-hmm. think your system failed in that it gave them a B? When you talk about the different parts that
yeah,
you look
okay.
at,
I can tell you that.
Company made a lot of money, very successful. Mm-hmm. It rewarded very generously its employees, so they must have been pretty happy.
Yeah, the employees, historically the employees have been very happy. So a couple of ways to tackle that question, Lila. You know, first of all, one way is there's this notion of corporate social responsibility. And one of
yeah.
the points that we make in the book is that the notion of corporate social responsibility is really pretty outdated because it holds companies, quite frankly, to a very low standard.
Mm-hmm.
By all standards, by the normal standards of corporate social responsibility, Goldman Sachs is a very responsible firm. It's doing, quote, all the right things that have been typically associated with corporate social responsibility, and yet I think we could all agree that its behavior has been egregious. So one of the points that we make in the book is that the standards to which we have held firms in the past are really astonishingly low.
Okay.
You know, this is, quote, a responsible firm. Another way, one of the other things that we learned in writing the book that was surprising to us, maybe it shouldn't have been with the benefit of hindsight, is we laboriously compiled all of the major fines and penalties against these very, very large firms. You'd think
mm-hmm.
such a database would already exist. You know, this in a world of increasing transparency, this is information that should be readily available to us all. It
mm-hmm.
is not. If you do your homework, you can find it out, as we did. You know, we compiled all of these. And as we were in the process of doing this, we said, well, you know, any firm that we find evidence on of major illegalities, law-breaking behavior, we're not even going to assign them a grade. But here's the problem. 59 of the Fortune 100, you know, have these major fines and penalties against them. Routine serial law-breaking is just kind of a way of doing business.
Yeah,
really?
Yeah.
That's built into their formula.
That's right. Paying the fine.
It's cheaper to pay the fine.
Right. It is a part of the shrewd calculus, the calculation of, yeah, cheaper to pay the fine. And, you know, I think it tells us that historically our fines have really been inadequate.
See that, Grace, nobody's holding these guys criminally accountable.
Yeah.
Yeah, no. You know, and
yeah,
and,
well, they bad a shame on you.
And there's really very little will to follow through on white-collar crime.
And the problem also that I see is that, you know, yes, you can always blame the CEO, all right? He's the guy, all right? Shame on you. But, you know, it's this corporation of snakes that is what, you know, that the whole corporation should be shut down. The whole place should be,
you know, I absolutely agree.
Everybody should
you.
Be
I,
jailed in the entire corporation
well,
you know.
And also revoke some of these firms' charters. You know, when there's evidence of chronic serial law breaking that is
right.
a part of the calculus, you know, charters are granted, charters can be revoked. And, you know, I think we need to consider that.
Has that ever been done?
Only in smaller firms for truly, truly outrageous behavior. But it's very, very, very uncommon. But I think we need to revive a discussion of that.
Mm. I think so far there's been very little will to even collect fines.
I mean, even if your corporation was involved with human trafficking human body parts, you know, they get assigned some Medicare number. You know what I mean? And be allowed
yeah.
to go ahead with it. Yeah, there you go. Yeah. So I mean, it's corrupt, man. I mean, you know, corporations buy politicians, and the politicians do their bidding. And, you know, I don't to manage to me, the one thing that caught me, and I don't mean to be maybe you can clarify this, is that the corporate mindset, okay, has been proven to be sociopathic. All right, they've done studies on this, and they found that the personality of a corporation is essentially the same as sociopathic individuals, and their leaders, or their the individuals leading those, have a tendency those companies have a tendency to be
that way too,
to be sociopathic. So it lends itself to a sociopathic nature, all right? And this is something that all corporations do. I mean, it's for the profit. It's for the buck. It's to keep, you know, make more money, make more money, make more money.
And a corporation is a soulless entity,
yeah,
that funnels people through it that are willing to do its bidding.
It's kind of like a digestive system of a monster. You know what I mean?
A different but a complementary point of view is, you know, you parachute, just take this thought experiment. You parachute somebody into, you know, some low-level employee person needs a job, you know, gotta feed the kids, pay the mortgage. You parachute them into a job in a call center.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's got its rules, it's got its procedures. It's designed to regulate things, have efficient processes. And those people may end up doing some very, quote, bad things.
Questionable.
Yes. And give them the benefit of the doubt. They may not even be aware of it because they're a part of this big system. You know, they're following the rules and processes and procedures. And so, you know, they become complicit, I think, sometimes without knowing it.
I agree with you, and it must be horrible to be trapped in something like that.
Absolutely. But here's the good news. Here's the good news, and I think this is the hopeful message of the book, Good Company, that we outline and we tell some great stories, I think, about this convergence of forces, economic, social, and political, that is actually forcing companies to behave better. Now, I realize it's, but, you know, with all the dispiriting headlines about, you know, Goldman Sachs bets against its clients and makes record profits, BP fouls the Gulf and it still is in business, GE makes billions of dollars and pays no taxes. Despite all of those dispiriting headlines, the good guys have the winds in their sails, and they are starting to pull ahead. Why? Because of what we call technology-fueled people power. There is a degree of transparency that is being created by the Internet. It really is power to the people that is unknown in human history. And this is a hopeful thing. It gives us power as consumers, and it gives us power as investors, and people are starting to exercise that to good effect.
Well, that's a really positive note. I feel good about hearing that. now, would you think about another book on revoking charters of bad companies?
You know, it is something we discussed toward the end of the book. You know, my co-authors and I, there are four of us, I should say, and we are quite a mixed bag.
Really?
Politically and in terms of experience, we have, you know, really quite a diverse, we're a very diverse team. The book does read like it was written by one person as opposed to, you know, four separate voices. So we had a lot of arguments and back and forth among ourselves, you know, because we do come across from a variety of political spectrums.
Tell us about your other three authors.
Well, Ed Frauenheim is one of our co-authors. He's actually the newest person to the team. He's a professional journalist and great writer, and so the really good stories in the book are crafted by Ed because the guy can spin a tale. So, you know, it's an interesting read because I largely because of Ed's great storytelling capabilities. Dan McMurr is really the analyst behind the book. He was a student of mine 20 years ago at Georgetown University when I was a professor there, the smartest guy I ever met. So when I went to leave the university, I said, hey, you come with me. And he and I have been working together ever since. So he's done all of the kind of the heavy-duty analysis and comparing the good companies to the bad companies and coming up with the quantitative systems. And then Larry Costello is the fourth co-author. And he's a real corporate type. He's worked in big, Fortune 100 companies. And, you know, as you might imagine, has a somewhat different political point of view than some of the rest of us. So we had to kind of hammer out some perspectives that we could all agree on. And in some ways, I think the book is, although most of us are in fact, quite left-leaning, I think the book is in some ways quite apolitical. My husband got up one day and he said, you know, I think you've written a book that both Occupy Wall Street and Wall Street should be able to agree on. You know, we're seeking to find a common ground here that can help unify us as opposed to tear us apart. Being a good company is, in fact, just good business.
Let me ask you this. In your study, if you were applying for a job, is there a company that, you know, say you were, you're young, looking for a job, and you have any kind of talent, and what company would you want to work for?
Well, if I were in the airlines, I'd want to work for Southwest. Apple, I think is a great company to work for. Ace Hardware is a good company. It's a good retailer. Here's my tip for job hunters of all ages, but especially the young ones. There's a fabulous website. I love this. It's called Glassdoor.com. And as the name Glassdoor suggests, you know, Glassdoor enables us to see into something that which is normally blocked and that we can't see into.
Mm-hmm.
Glassdoor.com collects employee ratings on what it's like to work at a firm. It's got the inside scoop and what the employees' rankings of the CEO, what salaries are. It even has tips on what it's like to interview there on over 133,000 firms.
Wow.
So, as a job seeker, it's a great place to go and look, you know, because you can get tips on what to expect in a job interview, even know what your salary should be, and
what
employees really think about this place, Glassdoor.com. And this is a perfect example of this technology-fueled people power that I've been talking about. It creates a degree of transparency. It's getting increasingly difficult for firms to get away with bad behavior. We know about it.
And that's a good thing.
I think that's interesting, but the way that firms are treating whistleblowers and the way the government is treating whistleblowers, by destroying them and ruining their careers and in some cases actually just killing them. And they just stripped the whistleblowers of much of their rights here in Congress. So where does that keep? I mean, if you do that, and let's say so many corporations are constantly fighting unions because they don't want that kind of
representation.
Then where does that leave the working man? Where does that leave the human capital?
How do you fight back to that? You know, we have some great examples in the book of people using the power of the internet. You know, sometimes just a single blog entry can go viral and literally change a whole industry for the better. We start out the book, in fact, telling a story about a single blog entry in 2007. Written by a guy complaining about Home Depot. You know, you can do it, we can help. Well, in 2007, Home Depot was really not such a great place for shoppers or employees, and he wrote a blog entry kind of complaining about this. Within a week, there were over 4,000, almost all, negative blog entries on Home Depot. So bad was this. This was the corporate equivalent of Home Depot being attacked by a swarm of mosquitoes.
Wow.
And
well, you
the
know,
CEO
you know, back,
had to step in and, you know, personally apologize on this blog site. So here's an example. Yeah, the laws may be swinging against whistleblowers. I'll confess, I don't know about that. But people have power, and they're exercising it.
Yeah. Well, that I just know that, you know, you see stories daily of, you know, every day. We cover a lot of international news as well. And these kind of management what can I say? These management training programs that they offer people there to do whatever they have to do at all costs. You know, and it's kind of like they don't have to use their conscience. You know what I mean? They're not told to use it. So it's kind of like being in the military. Same kind of you got to follow orders.
I would say that there's some good news. Yes, that's probably the prevalent point of view. But, you know, when you start looking at MBA programs, which mm-hmm. have produced these people, you know, the MBA programs are increasingly introducing fairly serious doses of ethics into their programs. Now, you might roll your eyes and say, well, you know, why should they even have to teach that? That seems like, you know, it shouldn't even be necessary, but
should.
It obviously is. And it's a trend. Now, you could look at that and say, well, the glass is really not even half full here. You know, the fact that we have to be teaching this, the fact that we haven't taught it. But, you know, it is, I think, a positive trend, because I do think there is this deep-rooted understanding at some very gut level that we got to clean up our act here, because people are starting to, you know, have the power to act against us if we don't.
No,
so back
I just wanted...
to Goldman Sachs. Go back to Goldman Sachs. You know,
yeah.
they raked in a bunch of money after betting against their own clients. But
yeah.
what the message of this book is they would have made more money had they not done that. So, yeah, they got away with bad behavior, but it has hurt them. They were downgraded today. Their credit rating was downgraded, and they're losing clients. And, yes, they're still making money, but they would have made more still had they not engaged in these bad behaviors.
Well, I think it's important to note, though, when you talk about Goldman Sachs in particular, you have to look at what they spawned, and who their CEOs were and still are. All right, right now, at the height of our financial collapse, if you will, in 2008, who was the chairman of the head of our the Treasury Secretary was Hank Paulson, who was the former CEO of Goldman Sachs. You then had the Governor Corzine in New Jersey, okay, who got voted out of office, all right, last year, started up MF Global Capital,
mm-hmm.
all right, our hedge fund, and is now and then absconded with $600 billion of their company's funds.
Can't find
right?
it.
It's gone. Destroyed. He's. I don't know if he is arrested or he should be arrested. I know they're planning on arresting Corzine. So if you look at these mega monster criminals, and I say criminals who are CEOs of Goldman Sachs, who brought about was responsible for bringing about the financial collapse of this last 3 years. It was corporate guilt brought upon by these greed-driven sociopaths, okay, who destroyed entire countries, played with. I mean, it's just amazing what they did.
It caused a worldwide calamity.
Yeah.
I mean,
exactly.
it's not calamity here.
And then tried to get bailed out and did get bailed out by the American taxpayer. I don't see any good coming from that corporate model, that business model. But, I mean, other than making a few people extremely wealthy, it made many, many more people extremely poor and extremely the economy wobbling to a collapse. So where does corporate wonderment come there. I mean, how to, especially when you see corporations holding back now all of their, they have trillions of dollars in assets, and they're holding back. They don't want to hire anybody.
And certainly not Americans.
And their trend is to not hire anybody because it means fewer people to do more more jobs, and you know, bigger profits for the corporation. J.P. Morgan was quoted recently as to a stockbroker saying that they had a 40% reduction in their staff and a 100% increase in their dividends.
Mm-hmm.
All right, and it's been a very profitable year for them.
A couple of things there. You know, one of the things we need to get under control is CEO compensation. So,
yeah.
For example, we're in the midst of a series of stock buybacks where corporations
right.
are buying back their own stocks because, quote, they can't find any worthy projects to invest in. But when a corporation buys back its stock, its earnings per share go up, and guess what? CEO's bonuses are tied to earnings per share. Pure conflict of interest, right?
Right.
You know, we got to get our hands around that. But, you know, a lot of this goes beyond just bad corporate behavior.
Mm-hmm.
I run a small firm. One of my employees, a healthy young guy with a family, his insurance, his health insurance is $18,546 a year.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's what the state that he lives in mandates. You know, we buy the minimal acceptable amount of insurance.
Right.
Now, if he were a $25,000 a year guy or even, you know, a lower wage guy, a $20,000 a year guy, obviously I can't hire him. And that's part of what's going on with our employment problem. It's not just bad corporate behavior, bad and greedy corporate behavior, although that's a part of it. We have major, major, massive structural policies, broken policies, public policies that need to be fixed. So both
yeah.
on the private side and the public side, you know, there's a lot of work to be done, no question about it. But it's not all just the greedy corporate behavior.
Well, I agree with you there. There's a lot that needs to be fixed. And I think it's great that you wrote this book with your four other people who brought different points of view. And I urge our listeners to purchase your book, Good Company. It sounds like it'll be an exciting read. And you were a real good sport
to tackle this with you.
Yeah, and even though we do have some disagreements, I think we can agree that all corporations could stand a little improvement.
Yeah.
Yep, I think we can agree on that. Thanks so much for having me.
Oh,
hey,
thanks
you,
very much. It was great talking to you, Laurie.
Have a good evening. Bye-bye.
Yeah,
good.
You too.
Good night.
Good night.
And we got John Brennan coming up. We want to thank Laurie Bassi for being with us and remember her book, Good Company. And you can check that out on Amazon.
I'm looking forward to actually reading it. I think I'm going to try to get it from the library.
And you can check out
www.mcbassi.com.
McBassi.com.
Yeah.
Yes.
And that's all in small lowercase.
Yeah. So check that out, and that's her website. And
I'm sure there'll be some interesting things on her website.
Yeah, and I'm sure you can get a copy of the book there. We got John Brennan coming up in just a minute. Music break, and Johnny will be with us. He's got a tremendous few things to do.
His computer's all fixed, so he's ready to go.
Okay, so we'll be right back with John Brown. right now.
I have him right on.
There we go.
Good evening, John.
Good evening, folks. That's really good to be back here again. I'm
well,
trying to
get having you back.
Here, but I'm having a little trouble. Oh, we got the wrong thing coming
former
up.
Former U.S. President George Bush and his former counterpart Tony Blair were found guilty of war crimes by the Kuala Lumpur War Crimes Tribunal, which held a four-day hearing in Malaysia. The five-panel tribunal unanimously decided that Bush and Blair committed genocide and crimes against peace and humanity when they invaded Iraq in 2003 in blatant violation of international law. The judges ruled that war against Iraq by both the former heads of states was a flagrant abuse of law and an act of aggression which amounted to a mass murder of the Iraqi people.
Bush and Blair are found guilty under the same law that applied to the Nazis after the end of World War II. They are international criminals guilty of Nuremberg crimes against peace, and they should be prosecuted by any state in the world that gets a hold of them. And we will continue our efforts to bring Bush and Blair to justice and put them in jail.
In their verdict, the judges said that the United States, under the leadership of Bush, forged documents to claim that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction. They further said the findings of the tribunal be made available to members of the Rome Statute and the names of Bush and Blair be entered into a war crimes register.
There is also a recommendation that this be circulated to states, because all states have universal jurisdiction. And therefore, whenever Bush or Blair appear within their shores, there is an obligation under international law commit these criminals, international war criminals, through the justice system.
Both Bush and Blair have repeatedly said the so-called war against terror was targeted at terrorists. Lawyers and human rights workers who are present here today say that the verdict by the tribunal is a landmark decision, and the Kuala Lumpur War Crimes Tribunal say that they would persuade and lobby with the...
I'm having a little trouble here, folks, with the audio. Sorry about that.
...to charge former U.S. President George Bush and former British Prime Minister Tony Blair for war crimes charges.
Well, I just showed you, I fixed my computer and the audio is still down, so much for that.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was... something from Press TV. I don't know if you had heard about that, or the listeners had heard about that. George Bush, Tony Blair.
Yeah, I saw it a couple of days ago, and I shared on my Facebook. We did mention it last week, I think.
Yeah, I think I may have sent it to you, but I wanted to play it to the listening audience tonight. Sorry about the audio breaking up a little bit there. In fact, it came up earlier than I wanted it to come up. Probably my fault here. I pressed the wrong button or two buttons at one time. But you got the gist of...
that video you wanted me to play today?
Yeah, there was another video I had asked you to queue up there.
Is it everything you ever wanted to know about the meltdown?
Right, about the economic meltdown. A lot of people think, you know, this is just sort of a boom and bust. It's just a natural happening that has, you know, something that it's just the way things are. Oh, the banks were so, they wanted to think, oh, we are so stupid. We gave away too much money, not realizing you couldn't repay it. Oh, we are so stupid. No, it's nothing to do with that, folks. They're calculating con men, crooks, who need to be put in jail.
Everything you ever wanted to know about the meltdown, but the bullshit news media never tell you.
Exactly, and I wanted to say what this gentleman will be saying to you, and he's a much better speaker than I am. So I'll just ask at this point, Leo and Lila, that you roll the audio track.
We'll do that. All right.
Mr. Black.
Okay.
Hang on there, John.
Okay, it's okay. We've got plenty of time.
Right here.
Yeah, I got it. I got it.
Yeah, it's an excellent piece of work by this William Black.
Really?
Okay, so I'm coming with them.
Yes.
Wait a minute. I hope we can get it.
Yeah, my audio was fine all night before I came on air, and at the last second, the skipping.
Message of hope, actually.
There you go.
In the savings and loan crisis, which was 1/70th the size.
Oh, boy.
I'm going to have the skips in there. I've been getting that a lot, too.
I don't understand it. My audio was fine till I got on air.
Our agency made over 10,000 criminal referrals, and that resulted in the...
You know, I may be able to pull it up on my end if you want.
Yeah, go ahead and try.
Maybe it's getting better, but for some reason...
Conviction on felony grounds of over 1,000 elites in what were designated as major cases.
This would be great to hear.
Yep. I don't know why it's...
It doesn't. It's, a lot of times, I don't know if it's the tape itself...
And to pick up on what's just been said.
This happens, it seems like it's trying to catch up to the...
Yeah,
I'm going to just see if I can bring it up here.
We'll work on it. In the meantime, we'll keep this on.
Okay, so I'm coming...
Looks like I got it here.
...message of hope. Not
some side. Go ahead.
Light. In the savings and loan crisis, which was...
Yeah, okay, John.
Sorry, I'm out of sync with you here. Are you guys going to play it, or will I try and bring it up on my end?
Yeah, because it's not coming right with ours.
Okay, I'm going to give it a shot from this end. So please stay with us, folks out there in the listening audience. I'm going to see if we can bring it up here, and tell me if it's not loud enough.
Right. So I'm coming with a message of hope, actually.
Good job.
The savings and loan crisis, which was 1/70th the size of this crisis, our agency made over 10,000 criminal referrals, and that resulted in the conviction on felony grounds of over 1,000 elites in what were designated as major cases. And to pick up on what's just been said, this is not some sidelight to economics. This is why we have recurrent intensifying crises, is these epidemics of fraud led from the C-suite, from the CEOs and the CFOs. The savings and loan crisis, the inevitable National Commission said fraud was invariably present at the typical large failure. In the Enron era, always frauds from the very top of the organization. And in this crisis, the frauds came from the top of the organization again. But what's different in this crisis? In this crisis, the same agency that I worked with that made over 10,000 criminal referrals in a tinier crisis made 0 criminal referrals. They got rid of the entire function. And so there are 0 convictions of anybody in the elite ranks of Wall Street. And if they can defraud us with impunity, then they will cause crisis after crisis, and they will produce maximum inequality. The group that has the audacity to refer to itself as the productive class is the largest destroyer of lives, of jobs, and of wealth of any group ever produced in this world. They wiped out 6 million existing jobs and 5 to 6 million jobs that would have been created. As you've heard, they've left 26 million Americans wanting full-time work with no ability to find that work. If you look at just losses in the household sector, it is $11 trillion. A trillion is 1,000 billion. And then they had the nerve to say they are the productive class, And not this journalist, but what we get as faux journalism today repeats this endlessly as if it were a fact, that they create jobs, they destroy jobs, they are mass destroyers of jobs. I told you I would bring you a message of hope. I will disagree a little bit with a fact pattern about the Reagan administration and re-regulation on savings and loans, because that's where I was. I will tell you this. Everybody opposed our re-regulation of the industry. The big deregulation bill, the equivalent of the repeal of Glass-Steagall and such, occurred in 1982, became effective in 1983. By November 1983, we were already re-regulating the savings and loan industry. And we were called re-regulators because that was the greatest swear word the Reagan administration believed existed, to call people re-regulators. But this was not partisan. A majority of the members of the House, at the time it was controlled by Democrats, co-sponsored a resolution saying, do not go forward with re-regulation. Five U.S. senators, who became known as the Keating Five, because the most infamous fraud of that era, got them together. And who, by the way, did that Charles Keating, that fraud, use to recruit the Keating Five? Brought them as a lobbyist to walk the streets of the Senate, the halls of the Senate? A guy named Alan Greenspan, who also put in writing that Lincoln Savings posed no foreseeable risk of loss. It was only the most expensive failure, a 3,000-position error. And after he got everything wrong in the most important issues he had ever dealt with, after that fact, we named him chairman of the Federal Reserve, because we promote incompetence if it helps the 1%. The Reagan administration was so outraged that we were closing insolvent savings and loans with great political support that the Office of Management and Budget threatened to file a criminal referral against the head of our agency on the grounds that he was closing too many insolvent banks. We had that problem recently. You see Geithner out trying to close the big, powerful banks. And the Reagan administration tried to appoint two members. There were only three members running the place. So this would have given control to Charles Keating, the most notorious fraud in the savings and loan crisis, selected two individuals to run the agency that would then not regulate him. One of them got knocked out on ambiguous political grounds, and the other ones I had to blow the whistle to get him to resign in disgrace. But, of course, they didn't prosecute him. We can prosecute these frauds. The Federal Housing Finance Administration has just filed complaints saying 17 of the largest banks in America committed massive fraud, endemic fraud, and that there is a paper trail proving that they did so. So where is the Justice Department? Why is it not indicting these clear frauds? When you are told no one could have seen this crisis coming, ask them about the subprime crisis of 1990 to 1991. It's a trick question. As all good things do in the world of fraud, this one started in Orange County, where you had significant people making liars' loans. Now remember, it is the lenders who put the lies in liars' loans, not the borrowers. We know this empirically. And we stopped that because that was insane as regulators. So guess what happened? The leading folks making liars loans gave up their federal charter, gave up federal deposit insurance, and became a mortgage bank for the sole purpose of escaping regulation. And they changed their name, and some of you will recognize this name, to AmeriQuest. Ameriquest, the leading predatory lender that, in addition to making liar's loans every day of the week, targeted minorities to destroy that wealth that you just heard about. They targeted Latinos, they targeted blacks, and they were caught, and they were caught three times doing this, and the Justice Department refused to prosecute. Instead, they settled for $400 million, and guess what happened to the head of Ameriquest? Did he, A, resign in disgrace? B, was he indicted? Or C, did we make him our ambassador to the Netherlands? Got it in one. Now, how hard is this to figure out? Why do you think we made him our ambassador to the Netherlands? Because he was the leading political contributor to the President of the United States of America. And that's bad, but what comes next is far worse. Remember, this is the most notorious fraud in the nation. It targets minorities. Everybody knows it does so. Two entities rush to acquire these personnel and this business. And their names? Citicorp and Washington Mutual, who become two of the most notorious frauds in all of this. So time-wise, I'll stop here, but the case is when we prosecuted, we had a 90% conviction rate. When they have the best criminal defense lawyers in the world and they spend money like water to protect the CEO from going to prison. So when they tell you no one can stop this, it is utter nonsense. Leave you with these statistics. The FBI warned of this in September 2004 in open testimony. It warned expressly that there was an epidemic of mortgage fraud, and it predicted it would cause a financial crisis. If that's not enough, the industry's own anti-fraud experts in 2006, in writing, went to every mortgage banker in America and virtually every other lender, said three things. Stated income loans are an open invitation to fraudsters. The incidence of fraud in such loans is 90%, 90. They are all fraudulent. And third, these loans deserve the phrase used by the industry behind closed door. They are liar's loans because they are pervasively fraudulent. How big did they get? Well, what did the industry do after it was warned? Did it stop making these loans? No, it massively increased the amount of these loans such that by 2006, one out of every three home loans in America was a liar's loan. And that's why we have a crisis, and it came from the very top of these organizations, and it went through, as the FHFA said in its complaint, the largest banks in the world were endemically fraudulent. It is not a few rotten apples. It is an orchard of one percenters who are rotten to the core.
Well, there's fairly hard-spoken words by Mr. William Black. And that was a by Wall Street demonstration, a very, very important thing for people to remember, that a lot of these things that have happened, kind of by chance, we're told, by the mainstream media, were well known in advance.
It's amazing that the FBI had information on that way before it happened.
So they've also, in a way, engaged in fraud as well. Goes to the highest levels.
Yeah, but not revealing it, even though...
Well, they did reveal
it to Congress...
And Congress refused to act on it.
That's right. That's right. And even things more lucrative, you know, for them. They put a blind eye to all of it and gave more money to the.
Well, the money that these corporations were making, they were giving to the members of Congress, the House and the Senate.
Keeping them
in their jobs, and that's how it works. It's a it's a thoroughly corrupt system. It's terrible.
Thanks for bringing that to us, John. It was good.
Excellent.
What else did you
have? Other little thing here I wanted to bring up, and I think I've accidentally erased it. It was about a chemtrail meeting that will be held in Suffolk County on December the 6th. It's going to be to basically try and ban the spraying of chemtrails. I'm still trying to find it here as we speak. Fortunately, I tried to turn off that audio a little earlier there, and for some reason... Now that my system is working good again, it's working so quick that it gets rid of things. You know what I'm going to check in is my mail here. I think I mailed it to somebody, and if I can find it here, I can read it for you again. Just take me a sec. I know we have 2 minutes, but we're still on air.
We only got about 1 minute left, so I was thinking if you maybe we could skip that until next week or something.
And then we could put it on next week and make sure we have it so that people can know
that's
about
true.
It.
That
Suffolk County is, which state is that in, John?
Well, it's Suffolk County, New York, but I'm not sure exactly what part of New York. I've probably driven through it several times. I know Columbia County and, Columbia County, Dutchess County, and all those other ones near us. But Suffolk County, I'm wondering, is that further downstate?
No, that would be west.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Actually, I hear it. I have it right here, right now, I believe.
Oh, good.
Real News Reporter. Okay, I sent it to Sandy Weddy, so I'm taking it from the email here. It's a bit slow downloading. I know we're just about 2 minutes before we go. Okay.
Actually, we got 1 minute.
1 minute. Okay, I can still. Okay, December 6th. New York Suffolk County government will hold a public meeting on the proposal to ban aerial spraying of aluminum oxide, barium, sulfur, and other salts into the air over the county without first filing an environmental impact statement and receiving approval from the county's Department of Health Services, Division of Environmental Quality. Exempted are a proposed ban on aerosol spraying operations for agricultural purposes.
Great.
We're going to lose our stream in about 30 seconds.
So we've got to sign off.
We appreciate you listening to that.
If you want to compare, it'll be at the Riverhead Legislative Auditorium, and that's in Riverhead, New York, at 2 p.m., 300 Center Drive.
What day?
It'll be on December 6th.
December 6th, okay.
All right.
Riverhead Legislative Auditorium at 2:30 p.m. That's in...
I just want to say goodnight because we're going to close it, but you can...
Hey, folks, I'll talk to you again next week.
No, that's okay, John. It's we're recording now, so that's we're fine. But
we want to thank our listeners.
Thanks a million for being on, though. We appreciated the report.
And we want to say goodnight to our listeners that won't be able to hear us, but you can catch us on the archives.
Yeah.
And thanks for listening tonight.
All right. And Johnny, any last word?
We're still on air or we're not. This is a very big, important thing about the chemtrails. And for those people who, I presume there's one or two listening who never heard of the word chemtrails, those are the streaks you see left in the sky, giant X's, circles, which spread out and cause it an artificial overcast. If you haven't noticed it, it's time you started to look up because it's something called geoengineering of your atmosphere. It's going on all over the planet, from Ireland to Australia and everywhere in between. And basically, it's causing weather disturbances, and people think it's because of alleged global warming, which has proven to be completely fraudulent. They're tampering with the weather for military purposes, and I don't know really why else they would do it. Maybe it's population control. Well, maybe one day they can just change the formula and sicken people over a desired area, and nobody would ever really know what happened. So it's important to kind of be aware of your surroundings. But these people in Suffolk County, New York, have obviously somehow been able to put enough pressure on their local government to demand a hearing into the whole issue, or somebody in the board of legislators there is allowing this to be heard. And it says right here, if the public is able to convince the legislators of the risk from these geoengineering operations. The legislation will then be voted on at the December 20th session. Otherwise, the proposed ban will be tabled indefinitely. Initiated by the Cindy Picolis and her husband Jim, along with Siobhan Searcy of Long Island Skywatch, with the assistance of chemtrail opponent Rosalind Peterson of the Agricultural Defense Coalition, the bill was finalized and proposed by legislator P. Romaine, and basically involved in Suffolk County government since 1989. Romaine is a fiscal conservative who prioritizes saving farmland and protecting the environment.
You know, that sounds like it's down on Long Island, Suffolk County, then.
I'm wondering if it is, yeah.
That's kind of what it sounds like.
Well,
so
I know the Long Island Skywatch, it's just it may just be that they have a more powerful kind of a group that's able to, you know, put pressure around, or elsewhere around the state. But
That's wonderful that they're doing that. I think that's great. And maybe other counties will take their example. That would be a wonderful thing.
This is the one chance for a major piece of publicity as well. So I have contacted a lot of the Connecticut Skywatch and individuals who we know who are perhaps prepared to get a group and go down there and be quite vocal that we are behind the local people there. That it's not just Suffolk County, it's Litchfield County, it's Dutchess County, it's everywhere, you know.
That's right. That'd be a wonderful thing, John.
Whether we can get minibuses rented and pack them up with all our people and get down there and be as vocal as possible. Because if they don't basically get the the desired ban on this at this hearing, it could be lost, a very lost occasion. You know, they're saying here basically if the public is able to convince the legislators of the risk from these geoengineering operations, the legislation will be voted on. Otherwise, the proposal will be tabled indefinitely. And I hate to say, but indefinitely means perhaps forever. So it's now or forever shut up sort of thing. So we have December 6th, New York, Suffolk County, you know, basically is the one that's going to be on the hot seat.
Oh, that's good. Anyway, so that's good, John. We'll talk more about
it next week, too.
And I think maybe if you could put something up on your website about it, it would help, too, or on Facebook. I don't go on Facebook. I'll send you the link, and if you could put it up and maybe just...
Sure.
Do that for me, and you can say, what's the link?
Suffolk County, New York, to hear proposals to ban chemtrails. I can send it to you. I'll email it to you.
Okay.
That'll be great.
I'll post it.
You could put some sort of a thing on Facebook, chemtrail opponents speak now or forever hold your peace, and then give the December 6th date and the address to go to. It'll be, like I said, it's in Riverhead Legislative Auditorium. That's Evanston.
They must have a
very strong group.
They must have a website for this, right?
I'm going to hit the activist post right here and see what they say. Let me see now.
Well, that's okay. It's okay, John. Don't worry about it.
Well, we'll talk more about it next week, and we appreciate the fact that you came on and brought us those audio pieces. They were very good, John.
Yeah, sorry about the audio at the beginning there. It kind of...
It was excellent, so that was...
I pulled in the trigger, so to speak, on the audio, and it broke up a little. But I think it was kind of important to find out what really goes on with this banking system. And you know, more power to the people in Occupy Wall Street, the more you stop and think about it, even if they're heavily infiltrated. Because
that's right. It's the message is still getting out, and people are learning stuff.
Well, I spoke to people recently who said the only problem with Occupy Wall Street is that they didn't occupy Wall Street with guns.
No, I tell you, they're right.
That'll be coming next, apparently, from what I've been hearing. The Second Amendment, right to bear arms people, feel that maybe they should go occupy Wall Street. And we'll see how the police attack them then.
I'd like to see them occupy Congress.
Oh, yeah.
Well, it might be coming. You know, that's the way people are talking at the local level here. You hear a lot of people are really angry, really angry. And the people
in the old days, they used to tar and feather people and send them out of town on a rail.
Well, they won't be that kind this time.
Traitors and traitors.
Traitors.
Well, Johnny, we want to thank you for joining us tonight, and we'll talk to you again next week, and keep updating me. John sends me some great stuff every couple of days, you know, videos and articles and he's a great guy to depend on, to listen to things that you haven't heard before. So
we'll talk to you soon then, Sean.
Okay, Leo, thanks for the great word there. And, yeah, very nice being on your show again, and have a good week. I was going to say weekend. We're on a Tuesday. So.
You too. We love having you. Good night, John.
Okay, good night.